Hello, this is Mark Shenton welcoming you to the second part of Theatre Voice's regular critical roundups. We've already looked at a series of new plays at the National and Royal Court, and now I'm joined once again by critics Charles Spencer of the Daily Telegraph, David Benedict of Variety, and Matt Wolfe of the International Herald Tribune to talk about a series of revivals. Let's look at them in the order that they were written in. First, we revisit the Spanish Golden Age and Pedro Calderón de la Barca's 1635 thriller Life is a Dream, being given a rare staging at London's Donmar Warehouse, in which a prince, played by Dominic West, has been imprisoned by his father all his life. He's briefly released, but then incarcerated again and persuaded that his freedom had only ever been a dream. David, have you seen this play before?
I have. I saw Calixto Baeto's version, which came down, I believe, from the Edinburgh Festival. Mm. And at the end of it, I thought, if I ever see that play again, it'll be too soon. I think I possibly slept through quite a chunk of it, and it bored me senseless. So here we are with the expectations discussion again. I really didn't know what to expect as I walked into the Donmar, and I loved this. I thought it was a remarkable revival. I think it's a fascinating play. He's the Spanish Golden Age playwright that's most likened to Shakespeare. It has a richness, it has a variety, it has a kind of play between fantasy and reality. It keeps switching. The central character has been imprisoned all his life, and he's brought into the light of day and then taken back into prison, and he doesn't know where he is. But Munby's production is strong enough to make sure that we always know where we are. The big shock for me was when I came to review it, I wanted to check a quote, and I looked at Helen Edmondson's, what I consider to be very, very impressive translation. I don't speak Spanish, so what do I know? But it played very fluidly. And I was amazed at how long the speeches were, because it didn't feel like I'd sat listening to people going, right, and now I have a speech that goes on for four pages. Every thought's been isolated, everything's been placed, and it's very, very calmly presented. There's a lot of oh, woe is me going on, particularly in Dominic West's opening speech. But he just plays it very, very gently. So you feel you're being spoken to, so the play then speaks to you rather than you being spoken at with these great long set pieces. I thought this was remarkable.
And that's aided, of course, by the Donmar having that incredible intense intimacy, isn't it, Charlie?
Yes, it is. But it is a fantastic play. I mean, it's not like quite like anything you've ever seen before. And it's the games with truth and illusion and what's real and what isn't seem terribly modern. But also it's also a play about, you know, faith and kingship and all the sort of, and a sort of Spanish honour play. I think it's a fantastically rich play. It's actually got a very small cast, and yet all of whom have absolutely, except possibly the clown, who, but even that's sort of fantastic, isn't it? Because the clown comes to a sticky end just when you least it. It keeps taking you by surprise, and it's just that it's a classic Donmar revival in many ways, in that it's absolutely lucid, very, very well played. You couldn't really imagine it being much better done, and also a real discovery. I mean, there's been a bit of a row about, you know, how often this has been done in the various critical feuds at the moment, but the only production that was sort of on most people's radar was the Calixto Baeto, or however you pronounce his name, at Edinburgh, which I must admit I saw pissed. But I think it's fantastic, and I really, really did enjoy it, and it's yet another feather in the cap of Michael Grandage, I think. He's had a sort of quiet last year. I think it was last year the Donmar won all the awards. Yeah. This year, not so many, but still firing on all cylinders, I'd say.
Matt, was it a revelation
yes,
to you?
Yes, I thought it was terrific. I mean, it's interesting the way, since over the last year, Michael Grandage has been directing mostly in the West End and on Broadway, he's been able to open the Donmar's doors to other directors who normally don't work there. Jonathan Munby did a wonderful Midsummer Night's Dream at the Globe a couple of summers ago, which really took a potentially very shop-worn play, and I thought absolutely revitalized it. This isn't a shop-worn play at all, but it's vital, beautifully done, and just certain things like, you know, that formidable Donmar back wall here sort of reinvented with sort of peeling gold of Angela Davis's design and glisteningly and sparklingly lit by Neil Austin, so that it's like you're looking at the Spanish Golden Age, which is itself very clever. No, it's terrific. I could have done without the flamenco dancing right at the beginning, which I thought was a red herring, but aside from that, I think it was great.
And a wonderful performance from the returning Dominic West, who we'd lost to the theatre a bit because he went off and did The Wire in Hollywood.
Yes, and a wonderful actress called Sharon Small, who looks exactly like Michelle Pfeiffer. It's extraordinary.
She was very, very good a long time ago at the Donmar and the Threepenny Opera.
Threepenny Opera.
And does lots of Telegies and Mistresses and stuff. But again, she sort of, she in a way, symbolizes what was so lovely about the kind of the acting throughout. You knew everything was placed. You knew exactly to whom she was speaking and why. Everything was properly considered. But instead of being sort of, I'm now going to show you exactly what we're doing, it just had an evenness and a forward motion. So you were never allowed to sort of sit back on anything. You were kept moving forward. Also, I would definitely want to single out Kate Fleetwood as Rosara, who is the love interest. I mean, her character comes to a very, very, very interesting end. Like Così fan tutti, she gets everything that she wanted, and then she realizes at the last minute, oh, I'm not sure that is what I wanted. But it has this great kind of upswing at the end. But she was incredibly fierce in a way that almost made you think, oh no, that's too big for a space like this. But actually, again, because of her absolute security in what she was doing, you just kind of bought into her passion.
No, she was very, very, excellent. She's a very good actress, I think, and slightly overshadowed by being married to such a famous director. But I do think, and I hope she gets the roles, because also a really good Breeches performance, I thought, at the start, which a lot of people can't bring off.
Mm.
Next, we go to 1923 Vienna for a new production of Bruckner's 1926 play Pains of Youth, revolving around six young medical students who wander in and out of each other's lives. Directed by Katie Mitchell and seen in the new version by Martin Grimp, it is playing at the National's Cottesloe. Charlie, the previous one was a revelation. Is this one much of one?
Oh, God, no. It was sort of everything one feared came to life on stage before you very, very slowly, I thought. Dreary play about a group of medical students having sort of sexual crises, but not very interesting ones. Loads of Germanic gloom, plus a Martin Crimp in the chair, never one to give you a joke if you can avoid it, and Katie Mitchell doing yet another of her showy productions, where she, this occasion, remained faithful to the text, but seemed far more interested in directing the scene changes than the actual play itself, so that we had stagehands coming on like forensic scientists with great big bits of polythene sheeting, and it was all so mannered and dreadful, really.
But at least,
and not a very good play. I really don't think it's a very good play. I mean, the play was done reasonably straight, and it's just a sort of bit of neo-expressionism, terribly predictable, gloomy. Who gives a fuck?
But at least she's abandoned the video.
At least she's abandoned the video, yeah. I mean, I'm afraid I sort of have to agree with Charlie here. A friend of mine observed that actually this wasn't Pains of Youth, this was CSI Vienna.
Great phrase.
That completely summed it up for me. I think what's so peculiar about this is, why choose to do a play that actually is of real historical significance? It's sort of like the characters from Spring Awakening, 10 years on, being completely fucked up and playing sexual power games. Everyone is terribly enervated and dissolute in a really dry way. But in which case, why give it such a dry and sort of arid production? What was so odd was that aside from those beautifully orchestrated scene changes with a great Gareth Fry sound design going on and all that kind of nonsense, every scene seemed to be played at exactly the same rhythm and exactly the same dramatic pitch. So it was stunningly flat. And given that people are having illicit sex and abortions and this, that and the other, you'd never have known it. It was as if Katie Mitchell was actually woke up one day and went, oh, I've got to do that play as well. Oh, I wish I hadn't said yes. Oh, well, we'll just do it. So she casts it well, but good actors like Jeffrey Stretfield sort of ends up worrying at a role rather than actually inhabiting it, because the whole thing is happening in an emotional range between about 2 and 3.
Yeah.
Nothing ever shifts. So it felt an incredibly long evening because it had no highs and lows.
Yeah.
Was it equally flat for you, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. We were talking about Cock and the clinical fastidiousness of that production, which I think is a way of James McDonald to take you actually further into the sort of tortured goings-on of that particular trio turned quartet. Here, there's a clinical fastidiousness as well, which very deliberately keeps you on the outside of it looking in, so that after a while you think, well, if the people involved in the production don't care about the play and aren't interested in taking us into the play, why should we care? And it's this strange sort of exercise mimesis, where they're distancing us, so we're distance. And I just thought, well, who cares?
Yeah, it's not a production, it's a display case.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, it is very, exactly. Very it's an installation.
Yeah. And also, this is a play about sex, and it hadn't got a single sexy moment in it.
No. Yes, there's a...
I love a bit of leather action, you know.
Thanks, John. But, you know, you can't really blame... You can't blame Katie Mitchell for the marketing department of the National, but, you know, the marketing department of the National have seen fit to put out a poster which says something about dangerously erotic play. I mean, it's as dangerously erotic as Wet Cabbage.
It could have been erotic, though.
But, absolutely, but the production absolutely is not.
But I think we have to say the most tantalising event of the theatre year as yet on scene has to be Katie Mitchell directing The Cat in the Hat.
Mm. Surely, that must be an inside a theatre joke, that kind of actual production.
I'm longing for that. I can't wait. If she does that with those video cameras and people...
Exactly. Well, we'll be back in the new year to review that. Now it's on to the American Wild West with a new production of Irving Berlin's 1946 Broadway classic Annie Get Your Gun, radically reimagined by director Richard Jones of The Young Vic, with Jane Horrocks as the sharpshooter Annie Oakley and Julian Ovenden as her rival turned paramour Frank Butler, presented with just a full piano accompaniment. Matt, you like me have no doubt seen countless Annie
Too
Get
many
Your Guns.
Annie Get Your Guns for comfort, yes.
Where does this one sit in the list?
Well, you know, at the risk of sounding horribly equivocal, I kind of hated it and sort of loved it at exactly the same time, because it is the exact opposite of the last Broadway revival, which was very foursquare, very dull. Bernadette Peters did her sort of cornpone accent and galumphed around, and then she left eventually, and Reba McEntire was sensational as her replacement, and the whole thing had a bit of spring in its step. But, of course, Jane Horrocks isn't any of these people, except, of course, she's all these people because she's an extraordinary mimic, so I guess she can make a stab at it. But it seems, on the one hand, not to trust the material. Jane Horrocks comes on with a Mickey Mouse t-shirt. The whole thing is done with a sort of travelator-style set. It looks like an elaborate letterbox. There's no real sense of period. But in a way, and there's much more to say than just this, but in a way, maybe that's how you have to do it, to reawaken interest. So, actually, in the end, I went with it. And the score is stupendous.
Indeed. I mean, they have chopped and changed lots of things. They've removed some songs. It has been boldly redone.
I mean, you know, the point about this show is it's directed by Richard Jones. Richard Jones is not, you know, the last West End revival with Susie Quattro, known backstage affectionately as Annie, get your P45.
Subsequently done, actually, with Kim Criswell.
Oh, thank you very much. You know, those were much more foursquare. Richard Jones doesn't do that. And there is, as Matt's just said, you know, there's a problem with this script that was written in 1946. You can't do the script that's written in 1946 because it's simply too racist. There's a song which they had to cut, obviously, I'm an Indian too, a Sioux, ooh, ooh. It's not a number you can really do with any kind of political sensibility anymore. And that's before we even get on to the sexual politics of the piece. So, you know, Richard Jones clearly falls for the score, which is stupendous, and then balks at the book and does a kind of production which is almost... Well, it is literally a deconstruction, the most terrible overused word in critical vocabulary. But actually, this is a deconstruction. It's a, what if we were to do this now, how would we do it? Presentation of the show. And as such, works kind of bizarrely brilliantly. You sit there having a kind of intellectual engagement with the material that's rather fascinating. However, if you go wanting to see Annie Get Your Gun and hear that score, with the exception of Julian Ovenden, who has got the best tenor voice in the West End, playing Frank Butler, a role no one's ever cared about before, you will be seriously shortchanged, because Jane Horrocks may be a mimic, but she ain't a singer. And actually, there were bits I was looking at the floor because her intonation was so bad. Poor Jason Carr, who's done the arrangements, has clearly had to move things through very odd keys in order to make this work. And actually, the role is underwritten for Annie, because she's got all those solo songs. It's not until something like Funny Girl comes along do you have another musical that's just got number after number after number for the lead woman. That's where her characterization lies. And if you take that away, because Horrocks can't really sing it and can't let rip with the passion and show you the woman's real heart through the songs, then you end up with a somewhat depleted piece.
I mean, there is something of an ironic detachment, isn't there, to the way the whole thing works.
Well, that's what I disliked about it. I mean, I think this show can work really well. I saw Reba McEntire, terrific.
Sensational.
And Kim Criswell was very, very good as well. And I just thought this was... I've got a real problem with Richard Jones. I compared him to a dog that has to leave his urine on every lamppost. You know, he has to leave his mark on every show he directs. It's always ironic with Richard Jones. It's always, we're going to do this differently. I would just, you know, Annie Get Your Gun doesn't, because of all the reasons you say, doesn't come around very often because it's so un-PC. I would really like to see it now with the song about the Sioux and all that, and I don't see why it shouldn't. It's of its period, and it was never written to cause offence. It may be offensive now, but let's see it how it was and really, really get to see it. And I wanted a full orchestra, and I wanted glamour, and I wanted proper gun effects and shooting, you know, and I just thought it was on, it, you know, it was all very clever. Actually, what they were doing is doing it on the cheap.
We haven't even mentioned the thing that would scupper this production were it ever to go to Broadway, which of course it won't, which is that you could not take a production of Annie Get Your Gun to the most Jewish city in the world and have a sequence in which it's even suggested that Annie Oakley hangs out with Adolf Hitler, which where I thought,
yes, there are
okay,
great, there are great
Richard,
video sequences.
You've got us there.
I mean, apparently all the rights holders think it's rather marvellous.
I'm told.
Presumably it gives life to a show that in lots of places couldn't be done.
Well, in any village hall in the world, since the setting is a village hall.
but I thought that having praised its intellectual coherence and credibility, I do think that there are also other problems with it, like Mimi Jordan-Sharon's lighting. She sort of lights the whole of the auditorium and not the stage. So as someone just said earlier, you know, there's a letterbox stage. Which controls the action and defines the action, but actually there's no choreography to speak of. Clearly Jones has sat on the idea that there should be choreography. So you get Sun in the Morning and the Moon at Night, which is, it's there as a joyous explosion. That's its point. And actually there is no joyous explosion. And again, there's sort of a lot of light hitting the stage, but also spreading right around the auditorium, and I can sort of see intellectually what that's about, but it's at the show's detriment.
But it's not an intellectual show, and it's so ugly. I mean, I just think it's so perverse, the whole thing. It's look at me, aren't I clever, rather than let's do this really great musical and give it fantastic, you know, as much value as we can.
Wholehearted.
I have to say that was sort of what I expected, because if you marry Richard Jones and Annie Get Your Gun in a show that has a song called An Old-Fashioned Wedding, this is going to be a new-fashioned marriage. And, you know, it is what it is. I think perverse is exactly the right adjective. And I can't imagine this production having a life. Maybe this scale, yes, but not the production.
No, it just can't. There's also, it's sort of, your perversity is somebody else's idiosyncrasy, but, you know, the four piano arrangements, it sounds like great stride pianists. I mean, the arrangements are remarkable,
yeah,
but it hits the law of diminishing returns, because the problem is that it's like doing a painting in exactly the same colour all night long. That you just get that fantastic sound of multiple pianos, all of which you can see being played in front of you. And that's rather marvellous. But at the fourth song, you go, haven't I heard this number before? No, you haven't, but it seems like you have, because all the arrangements are identical.
I'm just longing for some really sort of brassy entries from the, you know, a full orchestra. I just really missed the brassiness of it all.
Well, I did, as soon as I got home, rush to YouTube and listen to Reba McEntire, and it was just heaven, so I advise anyone else.
I put the Kim Criswell album on, it was also very good.
Next, we go to London in 1934 for a revival of Nicholas Wright's 1988 play, Mrs. Klein. Originally seen at the National, it is now being revived at the Almeida, with Claire Higgins as the celebrated psychotherapist Melanie Klein, Zoe Waits as her daughter Melita, also a therapist, and Nicola Walker as a refugee assistant who comes to work with them. Charlie, you presumably saw the original production.
No, I didn't, I'm afraid. I don't know
why.
I missed it. It was new to me, yes. I thought the first half was fantastically dull. And I don't really like the play very much. I still can't quite make up my mind whether he approves of Melanie Klein or doesn't. For me, I think psychoanalysis is absolute bollocks, really. Great believer in counselling and all that, but I mean, I just think that the whole theory of psychoanalysis is the only sort of branch of medicine that's got no pragmatic, you know, evidence for its usefulness at all. It does pick up in the second half when you get this big battle between mother and daughter. It takes a long time to get going. And Claire Higgins is an actress I can watch in anything, and is terrific. I mean, we've seen her do it before in better plays, but the sort of volcano of emotion at the end I found very moving indeed. But I don't know, I mean, it's a rather odd little play. I mean, I'm not sure if it's got anything to say about quite an interesting subject, really. And a lot of it is very, very flat.
I think that's the production. I do think that there's a better... I have also not seen it before, and I think there is a better play in here than that production reveals. It feels to me that it's been rehearsed but not directed. Now, that's partly because it was miscast and Kate Ashfield left the production and was replaced by Zoe Waits at very short notice. But I just felt as if there are climaxes which actually don't land because Sharrock is not fashioning this to any purpose. Scenes that actually have a shape have been oddly flattened out. I'm an enormous admirer of Claire Higgins, but I didn't find her completely convincing at the end where she breaks down into tears. I sat there going, that's really impressive of an actress being able to cry like that. And I thought, I'm supposed to be in the moment here. I'm supposed to be being utterly moved by the devastation of the central character. And I'm not being. I thought the performance of the night was Nicola Walker, who acted everybody else off the set. She sounded like virtually the whole of my extended family. Her German accent was flawless. And she wasn't doing accent acting. It was sort of like, yeah, I've done that. Now then, I'm going to make you look at the fact that there's stuff going on. But she never did that awful thing that actors always want to do, where they garner audience interest by indicating that something else is going on underneath. She just plays it straight down the line. It's incredibly unshowy. And the other actors around her were doing much more show and tell, which was not to the play's benefit, I felt.
Claire Higgins has a remarkable year, though. She did The Fever at the Port and then The All's Well That Ends Well at the National. I mean, she's an amazing actress.
Oh, I think she's stunning, and I have to say, I thought she was stunning in this. This is actually the third production of this play I've seen. I saw the original production at the National, which I thought this production was better than. The thing about the first production was it was very portentous, and it was also, oh, the trouble with Hans. And Mrs. Klein was played by Gillian Barge, just sort of a kind of eccentric anti-MAME of the psychotherapeutic world. And she looked kind of colorful and a bit batty. And in this, I thought there was something anchored about Claire Higgins, who, of course, has an ancillary career as a therapist herself, which I think feeds this performance, whereby you feel her commitment, obviously, to the psychoanalytic process, but she's also hamstrung by it. And I think that is very well revealed in this production. Most apparently towards the end, when finally she expresses grief about the loss of her son, Hans, whose funeral she won't attend. And no sooner has she expunged her grief than she immediately says, oh, but that was just the excreta. And I thought it was absolutely chilling, even at her moment of greatest remorse, she won't let it happen. And there's a very interesting reversal at the end of the play where you feel that the psychoanalyst patient relationship has changed and she's become the patient and Nicola Walker has become the analyst. I also saw it done in New York with the late Uta Hagen, where it was basically a vanity production. So this is the best production that I've seen. I didn't go to the press night, I saw it later. I think it's a very odd play, and I agree with you, Charles. I'm not quite sure what Nicholas Wright actually at the end of the day thinks about Mrs. Klein.
No.
I assume he admires her, because why else would he write a play about her? Or is he trying to expose her?
I think, well, you don't know, and I think he's...
But doesn't that make it interesting? I mean, why do plays have to... I mean, it would actually be extremely boring if at the end of it you went, well, I really think she's great, and we could all go home and go, well, why did I bother watching the play? Why didn't I just read the conclusion?
I can see what you mean about that, but I would like to have... I mean, I've got very interest in psychoanalysis, because I think it's a completely bogus thing. It just seems to me that it's not a subject that's being explored in this play.
Yeah, but then
is she for real or is she fake? And I do think, and I don't think necessarily want them to come one down on one side or the other. But I thought he's the sort of invisible author, isn't he? You never feel any character in. He writes like water, which may be a good thing in some ways. But there's no feeling of personal commitment to it.
I think sometimes that. Well, two things, I think. One is sometimes that really works, like the Vincent and Brixton, which Claire Higgins was fantastic in, and in fact, everybody was a beautiful Richard Eyre production. But also, aren't you in danger of bringing reviewers' baggage here by saying, you know, I think psychoanalysis is bogus, and therefore I don't like the fact that the play doesn't deal with the angle of the play that I wanted it to deal with?
Absolutely guilty.
But I think there's also maybe getting aside Nicholas Wright, so there's a bit of a physician heal thyself thing about it, in that, you know, what do you do? And speaking as somebody who, God knows, has known many psychotherapists and psychiatrists in my time, and I have lots of friends who are children of same, what do you do when that is your work and it has to infiltrate your life? How do you deal with that?
I mean, I think that's what
he's dealing with.
Yeah.
I think that's very interesting.
And the fact that he doesn't come down one side or another going, it's good, maybe, or he doesn't know it. Well, it's also that if you pursue that line of pioneering research into the psyche, bogus or not, it comes at a price, possibly, which is that you use your children and that people get damaged along the way in order to help other people. He's just pointing out that there is a central dilemma there. Yeah. And that may be enough for the play. It doesn't actually have to go, and therefore it's a good or bad thing.
I think it's one of those plays I'd rather have read an article about it than see the play.
Have to sit through it.
Yeah. I agree with you with that, Higgins. And isn't it time that they made a... I think she's absolutely overdue a damehood now.
She's so brilliant.
You know, she's
and the... as that Dench, Maggie Smith, John Plowright generation vanishes,
it's rather
she's
exciting,
absolutely
though, isn't it, that we've got
poised.
Her there, poised, yep. And ready. Yep. And I met her at the Standard Awards, and she's also tremendous fun when she's not pouring with tears on the stage. She's really great
she's
fun.
Great.
Well, one of the great things in the theatre is the Claire Higgins curtain call, because she'll snap out of angst into this beaming presence at the end of The Fever, having gone wrenched herself for an hour and a half. She comes on as if she's done nothing.
Or Death of a Salesman. Elizabeth Franz played Linda Loman in New York brilliantly, won a Tony Award, and every curtain call she looked like she'd been run over by a tractor. And on the West End, Claire Higgins came out beaming, joyous, as if we're going to get your gun.
Finally, we revisit Jim Cartwright's 1992 play, The Rise and Fall of Little Voice, also originally premiered at the National and now being revived at the West End's Vaudeville Theatre, featuring 18-year-old X Factor finest Diana Vickers in the title role and Leslie Sharp as her overbearing mother. Matt, did you see this play originally?
I did.
And again in New York, presumably, as well?
Well, no, I didn't see it in New York with the wonderful Rondi Reed from August Osage County, because it only ran for about 2 weeks. But I saw the original National production, of course, directed by Sam Mendes, and I saw the film, the Mark Herman film, which actually I quite liked. Well, David was talking earlier about expectations, which I think are very important. And I went to this production expecting to really dislike it. And actually, I liked it quite a bit. And I think it was partly because I went thinking it was just going to be a cynical, opportunistic exercise in casting some girl off television that I'd never heard of. And what I thought was good about it for me was that there was something about the original production, which at the end of the day was freakish. I thought Little Voice LV, played brilliantly but scarily by Jane Horrocks, was a freak of nature, and I couldn't get inside her. This was softer and truer, and Diana Vickers doesn't play her as a freak. And I thought the emotions of it emerged more clearly. Having said that, I would love to have seen Claire Higgins play Mari. She'd be a great Mari.
David, what about you?
I had not seen this. I watched half the film, which I turned off because I found it unwatchable, because Brenda Brethen flies so far over the top, I'm not sure she's ever come down again. I was really bemused by it. I think, as you say, that Diana Vickers does a nice job on Little Voice. Leslie Sharp is one of my favourite actors, and I think he's wildly miscast. I just found the play to be really misogynist. It's sort of, you know, the comedy fat neighbour, the mother that is punished for having sex. All of that is supposedly offset because of our feelings for the victim central character, but... You know, the deified dead father. I found this a really problematic piece. And I think that there are three performances in three entirely different plays. Because Terry Johnson is a really effective writer, but on the strength of this and also La Cage aux Folles, I really don't rate him as a director.
But it's such a good-hearted piece, I think.
I think it's terrific fun. It's really rough and ready. It takes me back to the sort of days at the stage and talent contests, and it evokes all that absolutely perfectly. Tony Haygarth as the club MC. I saw people like that, and it evokes that world, which I think Cartwright also knows very well fantastically. It's over the top. It's not really realistic. It is a fairy tale. What I loved about this production is Diana Vickers is really, really brought some truth to it. It wasn't, and you know, her vocal impersonations weren't very good. Notre Dame had much more heart than the original. It doesn't matter whether she's any good at it or not. It's the one moment where she shows herself, and I've got great hopes for her as an actress. I think she has a sort of passivity which is also interesting to watch, and I agree that Leslie Sharp, I think, is very over the top and slightly absurdly so, but very watchable, and the whole production is shambolic. But I think that's the sort of play that Cartwright writes, and I thought it worked very well. And I think it's unashamedly old-fashioned populist entertainment, this. I don't think you should look for any great depth in it. It's just about having a good time. And I think maybe some of those misogynist attitudes, maybe that's part of Cartwright's upbringing, but it didn't bother me.
But actually, one interesting thing, David, following from what you said, was I thought one big difference in this production to Semenis' original was in the characterization of the fat neighbor. And I say that in this production's credit, because in the original production, that part was played by Annette Badland, really as a running joke. And every time she came on, it was kind of sniggering. Whereas in this production, I actually thought you got a sense that for Mari, the Leslie Sharp character, this woman, who happens to be large, was all she had. And by the end of the play, you know, she's lost her daughter, she's lost the wonderfully named Ray Say, you know, this woman is it. And I thought that was actually played again for real.
Yeah, that amazing moment when she sends her away, she says, you know, leave.
Yes.
And it's heartbreaking.
Very heartbreaking.
She's got nothing at the end. No. She's absolutely
been stripped bare.
We're not going to agree on this, but, you know, I find the stripping bare of her by Cartwright to be fairly unforgivable, because the dice are so loaded against her. And I don't understand why she is punished so badly for wanting sex with Ray Say, who wants sex with her just as much. but because he can see a way out with money via Little Voice, he's allowed to get off not quite scot-free, but pretty damn close. I also want to say, in the production's defence, that I think Mark Warren is a revelation.
Oh, he's terrific.
He is absolutely tremendous, and he plays it sort of with the polarity of the very inexperienced but touching Vickers on one side, and Leslie Sharp, an actress who majors on truth, being asked to play a grotesque caricature. At the other extreme, Warren is right down the middle, and he's utterly plausible. I agree with Charlie that the Clubland stuff is evoked really, really impressively. They're the best scenes of the play by a mile. And I think Warren gets all that seediness and salaciousness without actually hamming it up in a way that it would be really easy so to do. And it's weird to use this word in terms of this production and in terms of this play, but he employs enormous restraint, and therefore he's much more watchable and much more engaging, actually, than that character ought to be, because he walks in the door and within about 2 minutes, you know what an opportunistic shit he is, and he shouldn't be that engaging, but Warren makes him so.
There's also a lovely engaging performance from the playwright's son,
yes.
James
Cartwright. Who's lovely and very attractive. When he comes out of the curtain call, everyone's like, wow, where did you come
but
from?
But it's a lovely performance. Yeah, it's, yeah. It's a performance
really
of
sweet.
Sheer benevolence and sweetness, which never curdles, I think.
No.
And in fact, in the film, Ewan McGregor plays that role also very sweetly, surprisingly.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting about Mari, we're ragging on Leslie Sharp being over the top, and you were saying you had to turn off the film because Brenda Blethyn was so over the top, and I remember in the original production people thought Alison Steadman was over the top. And I just wonder, you have three very good actresses here, if all three actresses who played the same role, they've all been described as over the top. Is there something about the role?
Well, this, you know, I of course am back on the misogyny beat here, but I think it is to do with the fact that the role is overwritten, and that in order to fulfil the requirements of the role as it is written, you have to disappear into the sort of the land that Faye Dunaway inhabited in Mummy Dearest. It's this, you know, northern extreme.
It's not quite a real play. I mean, it is an exaggerated
yes.
play, and also. Whether it's over the top or not, there are moments where she is fantastically funny, that character.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, and you know, Leslie Sharp, whilst she tends to get cast in sort of tearful, intense reaction shot roles, can also be bloody funny. And you know, to my shame, I was laughing at a fair amount of this whilst becoming more and more disturbed.
I think you need to feel ashamed. You know, take it as it is. You know, I don't always be worrying if it's PC or not. It's not a PC.
I
don't worry
about PC. I just, you know, I was offended by it.
It's good popular entertainment in a way that I think the Priory wants to be and for me isn't.
Yes.
And I wish it were good popular entertainment. I think it may be popular, doesn't make it good.
It's got
nice is different from good.
I think there's a generosity of spirit you don't get in the Priory.
Right. No, I agree.
On that note, thank you, David, Charlie and Matt.